seminar once a week for group to discuss these issues so that you're not alone. I feel if I had this group when I was in graduate school, I probably would have finished my doctoral dissertation.
The support, right?
The support. I said, you've got to look at that. You've got to look at, yes, these are the issues. You go out and you give a presentation to a group of teachers or school psychologists or whoever, and they ask you questions which you think are dumb and stupid, and, you know, you've lived in the society all these years and you still don't know this.
Yeah.
It's hard, but come back and bend.
Yeah.
You've got support here to do. As a professional, when you get out there, you're going to be encountering that all the time. You know, for instance, this group yesterday, they're all social workers, so they have a minimum of a bachelor's degree. And I don't know how many master's levels there were. I didn't ask them, but no. I'm there to do a presentation on working with Indian clients. And I assumed the knowledge base about Indians was zero. And I was absolutely right.
You go in with that assumption?
Yes, I go in with that assumption.
Yeah.
And I said to them, you know, I said, last class I taught at San Diego State was a graduate class in cross-cultural counseling. I said, you know, here these people are going into counseling. They're finishing up their master's degrees. And I'm in there, and I'm teaching about Indians. They've been through 8 years of elementary school, 4 years of high school, 4 years of college, at least 2 years of graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
And their knowledge base of Indians is zero. Now, that's not their fault, but it really becomes their fault if that continues.
After that,
we're not teaching people that they're about Indian culture, that we're working with Indian clients, we're working with Indian students, we're working with Indian children, that's not a part of society, and that's not a part of us being taught. And I think that's a frustrating part, that we just keep doing this over and over and over again. And so when our students get frustrated, and I think that the Hopi woman, that was a friend of mine, or she went back to the reservation, she said, oh, Marilyn, it's just so wonderful. I just feel so good. I don't have all the stresses. I'm not fighting all those battles anymore.
But there are so many other issues to deal with on the reservation that can be so overwhelming. Like we talked earlier about the battery, the violence.
Yeah, but you're dealing with that anywhere. That's not only on the Indian reservations. You're dealing with that across society.
Right.
Yeah. So those issues there are no different than if you're a school counselor in any school setting here. You're going to have that. The thing is, she found that it was just everybody's coming from the same cultural base.
Same perspective.
Yes. Yeah. And that she could do with the kids what she wanted. In terms of groups, in terms of identity, in terms of self-esteem, she could work on those issues.
Do you find that in talking to the people that are working on reservations every day, that there are special issues that, like gender issues between boys and girls that are unique to Indian children?
I haven't seen that, really. You know, it was a question asked of me yesterday at this workshop, and I don't know, they kind of all grow up together, and you know, I haven't really seen any major concerns that I would see between girls and boys. I think their major problem really always becomes their first identification as an Indian child. That becomes much more predominant when you're facing the school system. That concern, rather than I'm a girl or I'm a boy. I'm an Indian that the school system treats in a certain way. And I think that becomes the only thing that I can really begin to see that becomes a problem. Not the gender issue, but the racial issue, the cultural issue.
But do you find that because the children and, by extension, adults, have to deal with identifying or protecting their identity or creating or knowing their identity as Indians, do you think that maybe creates a difficulty for women in the community to have a strong identification as women together? I mean, I know in your background that didn't seem to be too much.
No, no, that was no. I think that they understand. I don't. I think the gender issue is separate, secondary. Mm-hmm. I think we have to identify ourselves first of all in terms of our cultural issues, mm-hmm. then secondarily, our gender issues.
How do you think sexism is addressed within the Indian culture today? Or is it?
Yeah, it's addressed. Kind of in a joking relationship, a joking manner. Mm-hmm. Oh, well, you know, all these men are sexist anyway, or, you know, in the middle, wait a minute, you know, this kind of thing. It was just like when I was doing the domestic violence thing, you know, talking about most women are battered. It's true, men get battered too, but, you know, most, the highest percentage of battered victims are women. I deal with those issues, and that's true in the Indian community just as well. And very often I think with the women, I think in the Indian community they're a little stronger. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of, my own personal feeling is, I'd like to do some numbers on these kinds of things. So I think battery goes both ways in there. I think the women fight that.
In some of my feminist reading, there's been some controversy, and interesting, and none of it's written by any women, it's all written by other cultures, white and otherwise, that there's been some controversy about the fact that with groups like American Indians or Indians, there's sort of this idea that if there's a strong women's movement, it'll divide the cultural movement.
Yeah, I subscribe to that theory. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that once we separate out men and women, then we're not working toward a common cause, which is the Indian cause. Mm-hmm. And I think we have to work together. I think we have to work together with the men in order to promote a strong Indian unity. Mm-hmm. And I agree with that.
So do you feel that through that strong Indian unity, there'll be a subsequent education of the men about women's issues or what a woman's?
Well, I think it comes up all the way through. You know, there was a thing on PBS a couple weeks ago about Cesar Chavez and the movement. Mm-hmm. Did you see it?
I didn't see it, but I heard about it.
Excellent, just excellent. When the women's movement there, and that's why I think the Hispanic women have a hard time as well, you know, they were talking about men in picket lines, and the men didn't want the women on picket lines. And the women got very upset. They said, we work in the fields just as well as the men work in the fields. We're out there just as much in that hot sun doing all that hard work, and our kids are there running around where they were taken care of because we work in the fields. That why is it we can't man the picket lines? And then, as she said, in another couple of weeks, there were more women on the picket lines than there were men. I mean, see, and I think that because with white middle-class women, there was much more a relationship where, you know, the woman stayed home and did all these nice home things.
Right.
Many of us who grew up poor didn't have that luxury.
Yeah. I know,
yeah. And so our battles become the same kind of battles, whether it's in the work field or, you know, workplace, whatever it is. So I think that whole identity really comes first. And all the work that I've done, that's what I really begin to see.
And one, it was interesting, I was looking through some of Troy's books about alpha tribes, and one of his books is all pictures. And then, you know, I was looking through them, his book. I realized there was about 130 pictures in the book, and there were 17 pictures that had women somewhere in the photo. And it was interesting to me, because I'm looking at it from a feminist, white feminist perspective. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to be multicultural, but ultimately I'm looking at it from my perspective.
Yeah.
These women were all cooking or caregiving.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the men were off, you know, looking like...
Yeah, like warriors.
Yeah, or protesting.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So what would your reaction be to that?
Well, I think they resented that, from what I gather. They resented that role. what's her name, Lenita Means, I think, brought that up. Certainly in this book that I'm reading that came out. And I gather Richard Oakes' wife started to play a much different role. I think that, again, like the Hispanic women, I mean, hey, guys, we have been in the forefront. We aren't wilted flowers. We've had to do all these things, and so therefore we're not the only ones that... I think that was addressed from what I can tell on the gathering.
Do you think that it's...
And then it depends who took the pictures.
That's a good
point. You see?
That's a good point.
Yeah, who was the photographer? What was he focusing in on? If it was a white male, the, he might not have seen the women on the picket lines and the women doing these other things.
That's a very good point. That's interesting. It's interesting that your perspective is one of, you know, presenting a side front. Has your experience been that the women you've worked with would be strong enough in their positions within personal relationships to say, hey, I need this, to their husbands or partners or to the women on the reservation? Would they have the ability within themselves to stand up and say, you need to do this, and we need to do this, and that's the way it is?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay. Just checking.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. I don't think there's any question about, yeah, hey, wait a minute, you know.
Okay, I just want to run through some things. So in the 70s, you did this Indian group, and you were doing your TA shift, and you were doing your doctoral program. That you
and I was teaching, I thought it stayed from 72 to 79.
72 to 79.
Uh-huh.
And then this Indian activist group that you were part of, the women's group, you continued with that, and you continued to help create the American Indian Studies Program book.
State
University. Did you, once UCLA was done, that was done?
Yeah, it was done. I never had any more to do.
And then after 79?
After 79, I left San Diego State and I went to work for Indian Human Resource Center.
And that's what we've been talking about now.
Yeah, Indian Human Resource Center was there for 12 years. Mm-hmm. It's an employment and training program for Indians in the urban area. Mm-hmm.
And is that sponsored through the BIA?
No, that's sponsored through, it was CETA first and then JTPA.
Okay. Oh, okay.
Yeah. 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 Job Training Partnership Act and CETA first. And that's still there. I just felt I was getting kind of burned out. Doing the same thing over and over and over again. And then I was offered a job with Indian Child Family Services to come and be a home-based therapist.
Okay.
So I did that.
Now, Indian Child Family Services, are they part of the regular social services of the county?
No.
Are they part of BIA?
Well, they get some BIA funding, but they're a foster family agency for Indian children. They are operating under the Indian Child Welfare Act of 1978.
Okay. Now, Troy and I had talked about your work on the act. The Child and Welfare Act.
No, I did not work on the act, the initial.
That was passed in 78, right?
Yeah, right. Okay. Yeah.
But you are very much party to and working under the act.
Yes. Oh, yes. Very much so. And I think the reason they hired me there is because I was dealing with a lot of their women when I was at the Human Resource Center.
Mm-hmm.
If they women needed training and counseling and everything else, they would refer them to me and I would work with them.
When you were at Indian Human Resources, what was your job responsibility?
I was program director.
Okay. And what types of programs did you have?
We had education, and we placed people in any training in the city. I used all the training facilities.
Mm-hmm.
Adult school, community college, whatever training was needed. They came in with some work experience but couldn't get a job here locally with no local references. I put them in OJT or work experience or whatever. Those were the kinds of things we did. And then I did a lot of counseling with them. I really began to help them with, because I'd gone back at this time and gotten a master's in counseling psychology.
I was going to ask you that.
Yeah, so I got a master's in counseling psychology. And so I would work with them then, really basically, on socialization to the urban area, socialization to the quote-unquote lovely terminology world war, and all these sorts of things. And I stayed at Indian Human Resource Center for 12 years.
Mm-hmm.
I as I said, and then I really felt the need at this point. God, I put in all this time here. And when Indian Child Family Services offered me a job, I took it. Liked it very much. However, the traveling was really horrendous. I mean, I really noticed it yesterday when I drove to Riverside and back. Did a workshop to get my coffee and home. That was an everyday occurrence. So I was offered a job out at Sequan as the Director of Human Resources.
Now, where's Sequan located?
It's just east of, it's 15 miles from my house, east of Elkhorn.
Okay. Yeah. I've seen the sign.
Yeah, it's on the reservation out there. So I went there in 1997. I went there January 1994, and I left there in March of 97. So I was there for over 3 years. Very, very strenuous, stressful job. And I didn't have, and I think that was one of the things that really bothered me. I really didn't have too much contact with Indians because most of the employees are not Indians.
That's interesting.
Yeah, yeah. It's only 4% of the whole 1,300 people.
Who does the hiring?
Is it done on reservation? That's what we did through Human Resources. Mm-hmm. There just aren't that many Indians to fill up this casino, and we got three casinos in this county.
Right.
And Sequan Band's a very small band. There's only 104 people enrolled in it, and it's a young population. So I think I was missing a lot of that, and yet I still have some of my old Indian clients come in to see me, and yet that didn't fit in with the work world. Up there, they'd come in to visit and sit and talk, and people would be calling, and people would be coming in, what are we going to do about this? And they felt uncomfortable. They started the domestic violence project with Sandy, Indian, Southern Indian Health Center about last fall, I believe. Last summer, last fall. And the director, the manager of that program, I was told by her supervisor to call me and have me help her, and that's how I got involved in it. Mm-hmm. And then I kind of really began to miss a lot of this stuff, because I was helping her, I was going out to the reservation and doing workshops. Mm-hmm. And then I found that I was getting into more and more trouble.
Now, what kind of trouble?
Oh, there are laws. There are employment laws. And some of the tribal people didn't want to follow them.
I remember you telling me that.
Yeah. And, you got to. I mean, this is the law. So it worked out that I got laid off.
Conveniently for you?
Conveniently for me. And, it's interesting because my son said to me, well, Ma, if you had resigned, and you've been talking about it anyway, because I've been talking to the kids about, really like to get out of this and do some consulting work on my own time, and just, do what I want to do. And so my one son said to me, well, you should have just resigned. I said, heck no. I said, if I had resigned, I wouldn't have gotten any pay.
That's right.
I said, And I've been saying this for the last year. I said, I'm just going to stay here until they let me go, because then they have to give me severance pay.
That's the best way to leave a job.
So I left, on good terms, really, basically. No problems, because I was a good worker. I developed a good department, and, all those things are true. It's just as I said to one of my friends, I've never been pushed around in the work world, and I'm not about to. And I'm not about to okay things that shouldn't be okay, and I will stand my ground. Mm-hmm. So, it worked out. I said all things happen for a reason. My last day there was March 17th at the end of April. I'm working 3 days this week. I work Monday, Tuesday, and Friday. Things are working out the way I want them to work out, and I'm doing what I want to do.
It sounds like your whole life is just like that. You just you know.
I just kind of do what.
It's like, oh, you're this now. Yeah.
My current husband says, he and I have been married 20 years. He says, well, another new career. You just keep changing careers. I know, when I get tired of one, I go do something else.
But it seems that you've always maintained, you know, a job that keeps you very connected to your community.
Yeah, and I think that was one of the things that troubled me about the last one. I wasn't connected. I was doing very much gaining jobs, which had nothing to do with.
It was business.
It was business and stressful business. and I knew that sooner or later I was going to have to leave it. Mm-hmm. And that it really wasn't me. Mm-hmm. So when I left there, and I said, well, it's all right, I've got severance pay and vacation pay, and, you know, the best way to go out. So I started calling some of the people around. I said, hey, you know, I'm not working at Quan anymore. I'm going to be doing some consulting if you need me. Oh, great. Yes, we will. And so, you know.
Yeah, the type of consulting, just for the record, specifically, what is it that you do? What types of consulting?
Well, yesterday I went and did cultural training for a year for Indian child training to Japan. And I'm doing these kinds of workshops, like I did relationships and domestic violence. And I will be helping Indian child social services at Southern Indian Health. They've asked for my assistance. I don't quite know what, yet they said that they, you know, I would be talking to them about it. I will be doing foster parent training. Mm-hmm. I did that a lot. And I think out here they want me to help them set up parent groups.
For the foster parents? Or
yeah, parents? Yeah, and just parents in general, about child, about parenting and everything else. And through this kind of program they had at San Diego State, which is why I'm very happy to be back connected with it. It's mediated learning, mm-hmm. and instrumental enrichment, where they look at the ecosystem and the children learn from the culture, and they mediate the learning from the culture. They also have a component of that in the parenting end. And I had never been able to take advantage of it because, frankly, when you're working for a place like the casino, it is, when you go to work in the morning and you leave at night, you have not had a minute to breathe.
Right.
I mean, it is
crazy.
Crazy making. I didn't even have time to read journals.
Wow.
The journals, I ordered personnel journal.
Right.
Last time I tried to take some time to read them, and I'll be doggone if I'm going to come home and read them at night.
Right.
After 10 hours of that.
Crazy.
I didn't even have them open. They were still in the cellophane that they came, the plastic thing that they came in. You know, and I'm the kind of person I like to read up on this stuff. I like to keep abreast of things. So anyway, to get back to the mediated parenting, they had a training here and I couldn't come to it. So Carol, Dr. Robinson, said, well, you know, she said, maybe you could set up a training now and contact a woman who comes out of Atlanta. And if you set up a training around here, you know, you get people to pay for her expenses and everything else. That's how they do it. It's out of this organization called the California Association of Mediated Learning.
Mm-hmm.
And they have meetings around. So I said, yeah, I could do that. Now I have the time. I could be here to develop, see if anybody's interested. And I said, if not, you know, I have a son in Atlanta. I'll just go stay with him and take the training at the Mediated Learning Center in Atlanta. Because I'd like to come out and be able to teach that to some of our young people so they can begin to follow through with parenting. And parenting from the cultural base. That's how I teach it. Right. Not parenting from
the white
individual. Yeah, right. And just before I left Indian Child, and this was another thing that I really had hemmed and hawed about because I really enjoyed it. There's a group out of Los Angeles that does parenting, and it's run by a black man, and I just pulled his book out today because I had been sent by Indian Child to become a part of developing the whole curriculum. I mean, I love that. I'm sorry I did that, but you know, we made choices along the way. And so I thought, well, maybe I would get back in touch with him and see what they're doing because they have done at that point they had four Indian people on the board, and the training that I was doing, Wayne Champagne from New Zealand was there. Therese Lacrombois, who is now back at Stanford, and Eleanor Bigfoot Sipes from Oklahoma was there, and it was really kind of interesting because they wanted to get involved in developing the Indian parenting kind of thing.
Eleanor Bigfoot, yeah, people like Miss Spice. I think I read the resume on that.
Uh-huh. Yeah, she's very good. Very good. They put out a nice little booklet on Indian parenting, which I had ordered and passed out to our Indian parents, and I used that. So I'll be getting back into that kind of thing, and I really want to get involved in this media.
Well, talk to me a little bit about the kind of the issues that need to be addressed when you're talking to parents, Indian parents.
Well, I start from, I try and tell them that, traditionally our children played a very central role in our culture,
mm-hmm.
not only with just the family, but in the total culture. And children were not abused. There was no such thing as an orphanage. Our children were to be nurtured and to be taught. Now, what has happened to us that we are where we are, and what have we lost? How do we go back and regain this? So we then begin to talk about culture and how this needs to be done. And I throw in some of the stuff on developmental stages because I point out that, maybe your expectations for your children are too high because you've got to learn that at certain ages they can't be. Or maybe you're too protected and you're not allowing them to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I do a combination.
Do you find that you need to address situations, I'm thinking about, you have younger parents coming into your groups, and a lot of these young people may or may not have contact or experiencing traditional Indian
culture. Oh, they don't at all. They don't at all.
So you're teaching them something totally new.
Yes, yeah. And, you say you're Indian, so you do this, and we've got to then, if we're going to do that, then we're going to have to raise the children in this way. And that's not to beat them, and that's not to nod them, and that's not to do all these things that are being done to our children to hurt them, because we don't hurt children. And, it gets them talking. It gets them talking about why they haven't learned it. And then I'm usually trying to bring in an idea. I do this all the time when I'm talking about cultural stuff. Is that our alliance from the Anadolu Nation has said very strongly that we've lost a lot. We have to grieve for what we've lost.
Yeah.
And once we have grieved, then we have to go and try and bring that back so we can move on.
Yeah.
So that our children are taken care of.
Like your granddaughter.
Yeah, my granddaughter. Yeah. Oh, she's a lovely young girl. I'm just so proud of her. But that even though she was raised in Berkeley, that's been stressed to her all her life.
Do you find that in your parenting groups that you get both mother and father? Or
sometimes both, yes. Sometimes both, sometimes one of the other. I try and I tell them that, I really like to have both parents. And then the foster parents, of course, both have to come as mandated by the state. So that's a whole different story.
Do you find that a lot of the younger couples that come in have adopted the, for lack of a better way, position it, like white middle class family structures, like the man's in charge, the woman is in charge?
Some of them, yes, and some of them haven't. Some of them, if they're on the reservation, where their families are there, it's not quite as dominant.
Mm-hmm.
And if they have, you don't put any side down or the other, but you really do get to talk about shared responsibility.
Mm-hmm. So you empower the women?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. So it's like almost teaching them what you grew up with.
Yeah, right, exactly. And, to point out that, when you share responsibilities and these issues, then it's not nearly as difficult for anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And the child learns that there's a shared balance there. Yeah. you know, if you say, well, when Dad gets home, you just wait until Father gets home. What an awful thing to put on a man.
Right.
Horrible.
Right.
I never ever said that to my kids. You just wait until your father gets home. If they were misbehaved, they got it right then and there. I never spanked them, but, you know, I mean,
you dealt with the situation.
I dealt with the situation when it happened, and that's what I must tell them. You know, don't make the father the ogre in the family. Because he's not. He's worked hard all day, then he's got to come home and discipline kids for something they did 6 hours ago. It's meaningless.
And the wife has, you know, obviously wants to come too.
Sure, right. Obviously. So, but you're going to handle it right then and there, otherwise it isn't meaningful to the child.